All right, Mark chapter 5 is the beginning of our story, and we get a very interesting story. There are some Bible stories that we come across, and maybe you're already familiar with them, but sometimes we read some stories that can be kind of sensational and stick with us. One of the points that I've been making as we've been studying the Gospel of Mark is that Mark is a very good storyteller. He uses the way that he uses language and details, he just tells such good and compelling stories. And that's, I think, the case again here. Mark does not include as many stories of what Jesus did as the other gospel writers include. And yet, Mark almost always goes into more detail in the stories that he includes because he's telling this wonderful story. And so we have Mark chapter 5. We're going to be reading this whole section, so you can follow along as I read. Mark chapter 5, verses 1 through 20. And just listen to this as a story and think about it. Try to put yourself there as if you were watching this story unfold, this real-life situation unfold. If you remember from chapter 4, Jesus has just calmed the storm with his disciples. They've come across the sea, and this is where the story picks up. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He had lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains. But he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you, by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told it in the city and in the country, and people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. There's a lot that takes place in this story, a lot of details, some of which we're not going to have time to talk about just because of how much time we actually have to be able to study this passage together. But what a wonderful story. I think as we read it, we begin to see how good of a storyteller Mark is, that we, at least when I read it, I feel like I'm almost there. I can understand what's happening because he's so descriptive. But he begins by talking about this event, and he places it in the context of what's going on in Jesus' ministry. This isn't just a random story. This is immediately after Jesus has calmed the wind and the waves. And he makes that as a very important point. And so if you have your bulletins, if you want to use the outline that I've provided in there, I've called this first point a divine appointment. This is a purposeful act of God, a divine appointment. Part of the reason that I say that is because what's going on here has actually caused some confusion over the years, mostly because of where this is taking place. where did Jesus go? Where does this event happen? My Bible has the word, it says the country of the Gerasenes, and then it has a little note next to it and says to go down to the bottom, and it says some manuscripts say Gergesenes, some say Gadarenes. And so there's been all kinds of debate and wondering about where this event took place. And some have even called into question that they said maybe this event couldn't have happened because there's so much confusion about it. Obviously, this is a made-up story. I think it's important to keep in mind as we read these things. I sometimes will say things quickly, but that doesn't mean that it's not important. And so I'm going to answer this with what I think is the best way to answer this. And it may seem like I'm going quickly or I'm speaking very briefly about something that's been debated for about 100 years. And I don't want to give that impression that it's not an important discussion, but I think it is actually fairly simple when we boil it down. This is where this has taken place. If you look in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, each of them give a slightly different spelling or a different location name. It's either a different spelling or a different location, depending on how you read it. But it's important to remember that when we're speaking about regions in the ancient world, the writers who are writing these things are writing to different audiences, different people, and in different places. So I think that we can tell from the story that we're talking about, this is happening outside of a city, outside of a town. We don't know exactly how big it is. And so, okay, we don't have the exact name of the town where this takes place. That's actually not that big of a problem, I don't think, because the audiences that the writers were writing to would have been familiar with these places, perhaps by different names. I want to give you an example of this. So I've lived here in Elverson now for about a year. But if people ask me, oh, well, where did you move from? I will often tell people that I moved out here from Bucks County, from Quakertown, because people out here might know where Bucks County is. They might not know the town of Quakertown, but some people do know where Quakertown is. And so I'll say both. I'll say from Bucks County and Quakertown. And then there might be other people, though. If I go to visit my brother who lives in San Diego and they ask me where I'm from, I'm going to say the Philadelphia area. They know where Philadelphia is, they know where Pennsylvania is, but if I told them Bucks County or Chester County, they would have no idea what I was talking about. So I'll tell them from the Philadelphia area. But if I went up north, where I went to Bible college in Scranton, and they asked me where I'm from, I'm going to say the Lehigh Valley area is where I was raised. I wouldn't tell people from the Lehigh Valley that I was from Lehigh Valley area because I didn't actually live in the Lehigh Valley. I lived just outside of it. All of these things. How could I say that I'm from so many different places when I only grew up in one house? Well, the reason I can do that is because I'm using the language that people would be familiar with, even if they're slightly different places that I'm actually mentioning. We kind of understand that. That's the way that we would talk to each other. But when it comes to the Bible, we almost put too much pressure on it, that these people didn't talk like regular people, that they didn't write like regular humans would write. Just listen to this and try and listen to it, you know, audibly and think about how difficult this might be for us, for our audience, to understand. This is what one scholar that I read this week, this is how he put it. The description of this place, where Jesus did this, it does not fit the town of Gerasa, but it does fit the town of Cursa, which was a town inhabited by Gerasenes or Gergesenes. It could also be assumed that the larger city of Gadara, which was a few miles southwest, is kind of the capital of the district. So the question we could ask is this Cursa? Is it Gerasa? Is it Gadara? And are the people from there called Gadarenes, Gerasenes, Cursenes? To us, in our language, that all sounds almost exactly the same. The people that lived there, these were all slightly different places. And I think that's the explanation of why you get what we might look at as conflict in this passage in the different gospel writers, is because they're using the different names that different people would be familiar with. I will say again, that's not the only possible explanation of this, but I think it's the one that's the most likely. And so that's why I've explained it to you, because I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's very easy to see how we can have this situation explained of where Jesus was. We still don't know the exact pinpoint location, but we think we've got it pretty well narrowed down. And it had all those different names, and so that's why we have those issues. But back to the bigger picture at hand, why is this a divine appointment? One, because Jesus is sent to a place that we still can't identify, and so God's hand had to have been in it, because we don't even know where it was that he went. But also, this is a divine appointment because of the people that Jesus is going to speak to. Who are the people that were called the Gerasenes? They were Gentiles. We know that partly because of where they live and partly because they're raising herds of pigs. This is something that the Jewish people were simply not allowed to do because of the Old Testament law. They're also part of what's called the Decapolis. The Decapolis, that word that's mentioned at the end, it's a collection of 10 Greek and then later Roman cities. They had been controlled by Israel at some point, but then they had been taken over by the Greeks and Romans, and then they were later given a little bit of their own home rule. These 10 cities were allowed to kind of work together, and they were allowed to kind of rule themselves. But what we know about this is it's a Gentile region. So why is Jesus here at all? Why did Jesus come to speak to these Gentiles? He must have some very big plans. He must have something really, really important on his mind. And here it is, this story that we have just read. This is his one act in this area. It's the only thing that he does. We read it. As soon as this event is over, he immediately gets back in the boat and crosses back over to the Israel side of the sea. In all three different gospel accounts of this, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all tell the story focusing on different details and highlighting different bits of what happened that day, but the one detail that they all include is that Jesus calmed the storm on the way to this place, he cast these demons into the herd of the pigs, and then he went back to Capernaum. So the only reason that Jesus brought his disciples into the storm to go across to this land seems to be to show them that he can be trusted and to have mercy on this individual. This is why Jesus came here. It was not a mistake. They didn't just get blown off course and Jesus said, oh, I guess we better get back in the boat and go back. This is what Jesus came to do. He meant to come to this exact location that we still can't quite pin down. He meant to come to speak to this Gentile. And he meant to display his power and his mercy in his life. So that is why I'm calling this a divine appointment. But next, and most of what we see here is an explanation of Jesus' divine mercy on display. He shows us his mercy so much in this passage. Before we continue on, I'm going to be using that word a lot, mercy. But what does that mean? Mercy is choosing not to give consequences which are deserved. It's saying, I know that what you deserve for the wrong things that you do, but I will hold back the consequences. Not because I have to, not because the consequences are wrong to give, but because I choose to hold them back out of love. That's what mercy is, holding back consequences that we deserve. And the extent of the mercy that Jesus shows here is staggering. The point flows from what we've just heard a minute ago. Jesus coming to this person, coming to this place to show mercy on him. Again, what kind of place is this? Jesus is coming to show his mercy to Gentiles. Mark is making a huge statement when he points to this and when he includes it, as the others do, at this point in Jesus' ministry. In Mark, Jesus has just spent days explaining these parables to people, or telling parables to the Jewish people. He has taught them and quoted from the Old Testament to them about their understanding, and that even though he has been sent by God to deliver a message of salvation, they're not understanding him. They're not listening to him. They're not paying attention. So then he gets into the boat, and his disciples, the question he asks them after they've feared for their lives is, have you still no faith? Do you still not trust me? Even after everything he's taught them, even after what they've been through together, they still didn't seem to have faith in him. So now it's at this point that he's going to display mercy to the Gentiles, to people who are not Jewish by birth, who did not follow the Old Testament law. Jesus is not done with his disciples. He's not done with the nation of Israel. But Mark shows us that Jesus is doing something here. He's asked his people if they believed, and their response was confusion and rejection. So he will go to the nations, and he'll display his mercy toward them and see what their response is. We need to see what this shows us about God and about God's character. On whom does God have mercy? Does God have mercy on his favored people and on the people who are his friends? Yes. Yes, he does have mercy on his favored people. But it's not only his favored people, the Jews, that he has mercy on. It's not just his inner circle. No, his mercy is for people who are far off. It's for the pig farmers, the Gentiles, the Roman citizens. Jesus' mercy is for everyone. There's no type of person that God will not extend mercy toward. This is good news to me. It should be good news to all of us. Because the Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, but God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, he made us alive together with Christ. For by grace you have been saved. This is the very heart of the gospel message, the very heart of the good news of Jesus Christ. That God shows his love for us, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were his enemies, when we rebelled against him, we were in no better position than this man who's possessed by a legion of demons. God is gracious and merciful. He's slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Do we see the extent of the mercy that Jesus is showing in this story? Jesus has shared God's plan of salvation with his people, the Jews. And now he's beginning to share it with those who are outside the Jewish community, the Gentiles, all kinds of people. Jesus took compassion on this man. He had mercy on him that everyone else had written off. And Jesus even kind of shows mercy to the demons. Kind of. And so the first way that Jesus displays his mercy is by coming to this Gentile village at all. But his mercy doesn't stop there. When the demons come to him and ask not to be sent away or tormented, but sent into the pigs instead, I wonder, have you ever thought about Jesus' answer? About Jesus' response? Why should Jesus not torment these demons? Why should he not send them into the abyss? Why should he not do whatever he wants with them? Why should he let them even talk to him? He doesn't need to give them what they want. He doesn't even need to give them the time of day. Why should he grant their request? Well, the answer is not that Jesus lacked control over the situation. He certainly had the power to do it, and he does. The answer, I think, is that God, Jesus, is a God of mercy. He stoops even to their level and interacts with them. He's still the one who decides how he will act and what they will do, but he decides to act in mercy. He grants the demon's request. But it's an interesting way of showing mercy. It's not ultimately mercy toward the demons. It is ultimately mercy toward the man that he is still removing the demons from. But it's just an interesting thing to think about. It's not the main point, but why should Jesus even listen to the demons? doesn't have to, but he is willing to be patient. He is willing to send them into the pigs as they requested. Just an interesting thing to think about. But it does bring us back to the main point of this episode, which is the mercy on the man who was possessed by these demons. This is a man who is unclean. A man who is unclean by, I think, every metric that you could have. Whatever your standard for cleanliness is, this man was unclean. He was a Gentile. We've already talked about that a little bit. He was not part of the people of God. He was also living among the tombs. Under the Old Testament law, seeing a person who was dead was enough to make you ritually unclean and unable to enter the temple, unable to come into the presence of God. You needed to go through a period of waiting and cleansing if you had just seen someone who was dead. Living in tombs? That is not even comprehensible by the first century Jews. That would make a person completely unclean, completely unfit to come into God's presence. But it also makes a person not clean. This might be the understatement of the year. It was unsanitary to live in first century tombs. It was not a good place to go. So he is dirty. He is filthy. He is living in a horrible place. He's also ceremonially unclean. He is religiously unclean. He's from an unclean people. And to top it off, he's possessed by a legion of demons. If there's a scale of how spiritually clean a person can be, I think that this person is at the bottom of the scale. Things are so bad for this man. He's been ostracized by his own community. Even other Gentiles, not living under God's law, see him as a problem and want nothing to do with him. Partly because of his violence, but also partly because they rightly recognize that there's something wrong. There's something wrong. So what does he do when he sees Jesus? What should he do? Well, what he does is he comes running to Jesus. This is a shock in itself, that he should come running to Jesus. But what does verse 10 say that he asked? It says, he begged him, that's Jesus, so the man begged Jesus earnestly not to send them out of the country. He begged Jesus not to send the demons away. That's probably not the response we expect. It's not what we come to expect. As you read the gospel stories, you expect people to come to Jesus and say, Jesus, please heal me. Jesus, please cast these demons out. Jesus, please change me. This man does not say that. He says, Jesus, please go away and leave me exactly the way that I am. He begged him not to send them out. One of my favorite writers is Sinclair Ferguson, and he wrote this. Would you not think that a man with such a profound need would yield readily to Jesus the deliverer? In theory, we would think that. But to think that would suggest that we understand the human heart all too superficially. No one yields to Jesus easily by nature. Tragically, like Legion, men often hold on to their bondage in evil rather than yield to the pain of transformation by Christ's power and grace. We see that in the world around us, don't we? It's true for each one of us and everyone in the world. Wherever you're at on that scale, going through life unclean, whether it's spiritually unclean, someone who's maybe just been forgotten, somebody who's broken, someone who's been abused or kicked out of your community, someone living your life as if you're shrieking in misery and pain, wherever you're at, we would think, well, just come to Jesus. But because of our brokenness, because of the sinfulness of our own hearts, our pain almost seems better the way that it is than to have to confront our sin, to have to deal with the transforming power of the gospel. The saying is, what, better the devil you know, right? Well, what if I come to Jesus and he asks me to do something more painful? But God, in his mercy, he condescends. He comes down to this man's level. He shows him his love and his compassion by not giving him what he asked for. But instead, freeing this man from his sin and oppression. He shows him what his soul is actually worth. It's worth the pain of transformation. It is worth the cost of a herd of pigs. It's worth even the hatred of the rest of the town. Jesus, in his grace and in his mercy and love, he does not send the demons away into the air or into the abyss. He also doesn't send them out into another country to continue to do their work. Instead, he allows the demons to go into this herd of pigs because it is a mercy for this man. He is now able to watch these demons leave and go down into the sea and drown and be dealt with. And they will not come back to him because of that. He's able to watch them go. He's able to see his oppression leave. Jesus mercifully does not give this man what he wants, but he gives him what he needs. The story has something very important to say in our day, to us and to people in our world. Dealing with sin, dealing with our own hearts, is difficult and it is painful at times. It's hard, maybe impossible even, to admit that maybe I am the one that's wrong. Maybe what I feel like my life should be like is not right. Maybe there's something, someone out there who is greater than me that can tell me that I do need to change. That I don't get to just decide everything about my own life. Maybe what I want is wrong. That's a hard thing to admit. But to think that the solution is to say to Jesus, okay, I'll come to you, Jesus, but just let me stay the way that I am. Don't change me. Don't take away these things that I've really come to embrace, even though they're contrary to what you want. But I embrace them about myself, and so please, Jesus, I'll come to you, but don't change me. We see this all over in our culture. We see this all over in our churches. And to some degree, I want us to be careful here, to some degree, we see this in our own hearts. It might be easy to look at a specific group of people or a specific person that we know and think, yeah, this is true of them, without looking at our own hearts first. We tell God that we want him our way. If he would just leave some of the areas of our life alone, we'll give the rest to him. Are we willing to actually say, you can change all of me? Jesus does not say, okay, that's fair enough. Here you go, I'll give you eternal life, but you can keep on living whatever way you want. That's not what he says. That's not how he acts. No, in true mercy and love, he refuses to leave his children where they began. He does not give us what we want, but what we need. He transforms our whole life to become more like him each day as we grow in him. And so to deny that there is the possibility or even the necessity of transforming power in the gospel denies any power to the gospel at all. If Jesus can just come and be your friend and help you, but you never have to actually have a change of heart, have a change of life if your life does not match his desires, then what you're looking for is not a God. You are looking to be God yourself. If God never has any other thoughts than you have, if God never has any desires other than your desires, the reason is because you see yourself as God, as the one who is right in all things. We shouldn't want that, because I know myself. If I was God, I'd be terrible at it, if I'm willing to admit it. Are we willing to trust that God's way and God's plan is the one that we should desire? Well, when we look at Jesus' mercy to this man, I think we should consider that Jesus is the one that we should follow. Look at what he's done for this man. He was an outcast because of his possession. He was dirty, he was unclean, he was violent, and he was a sinner far from God. But now, we can see what the Lord has done for him, how his mercy has changed him. As you read this passage, it becomes clear how drastic the change was in this man. Verse 15 says, they came to Jesus and they saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. Now first, there's two quick things to notice. And first, very quickly, notice how Jesus works spiritual transformation in the life by casting out the demons and drawing him to himself. But he and his followers also provide for the physical needs of the man. This was a man who was living naked in the tombs and now is sitting, having conversation with people again for the first time in who knows how long, clothed in his right mind. They have actually taken care of this man's physical needs. It's not the focus of the story, but it is one detail that Mark includes. They did take care of this man's physical needs. And secondly, I want to be clear about this. Many times, the transformation that we see is not experienced in quite as drastic of terms as this man has experienced. Most of us will not have the experience of being possessed by a legion of demons and having an exorcism and an immediate transformation of life. This is a wonderful miracle. The normal way that God transforms a person takes usually more than a few minutes or hours, although he can work as quickly as he wants. And he still does at times. The normal way that we see transformation take place is through a lifetime of surrender to Christ. In fact, not even this man is done being transformed. He still had things to learn. He still had transformation to go through. His was just drastic because of his starting point. But life change and transformation does, in fact, take place through the mercy of God. And it will become noticeable to the people who know you. The final point this morning is on the response to mercy. I spent a lot of time on point number two, and so I'm going to move a little quicker through point number three. How do we respond to mercy? Well, what are the responses that we see in the text? There are two of them. Two responses. The first is that of the herdsmen and the people of the town. They see what has happened. They see what Jesus has done, the power that he has displayed, the mercy he has had on this man, and they tell their friends. The whole town comes out to investigate, and they're afraid. They're afraid of Jesus and what he has done. They find out that their herds of pigs are gone. Their profits and probably much of their food has been drowned in the sea. And they also find this man that they have hated and feared for so long. They find him in his right mind. He's been totally changed. And so on balance, how would you respond to that situation? Everything has changed. Everything is different in a matter of minutes. They realize that Jesus was the one responsible for all of this. And so they're afraid of him because of his power, because of what he can do. And they're probably a little bit upset with him because he has actually, killed these 2,000 pigs. Or these 2,000 pigs have died because of this event. Mark gives us that detail. There's about 2,000 of them. That's a lot. It's a large herd. One reason for fear is because of Jesus' power. Another is because they're afraid that if he stays, he'll ruin their town and their businesses and perhaps destroy their property. The indication here, I think, is that they're more scared of Jesus' power, his authority over all things, and they don't want that. That's not what they're looking for. And so if you're here today or if you're listening to this sermon, and you've been responding to Jesus in fear and frustration because You've seen what he does to other people. You've seen how he changes other people, and you don't want that. I have to ask, are you going to continue to respond like these herdsmen, like these townspeople? It'd be fine for Jesus to come and visit if he doesn't do anything, but we don't actually want him to change anything in our lives. What you're doing is denying the power of the gospel, denying that this mercy is actually available for you. Will you continue to deny that and just ask Jesus to go away? Maybe you even say, I know that you can do wonderful things, but it's just not for me. After 2,000 years of people asking Jesus and his transforming message to go away, he's still here. And the message is still here. Repent, turn away from your sins, and call on him to be Lord. It's not going to be easy, and it will not be comfortable. But the way of rejection and continuing in your sin, that leads to death and darkness. Only God in his mercy offers you life and light through Jesus Christ. But this response is immediately contrasted by the response of the formerly possessed man. Those people came and they begged Jesus to leave, but the man comes and he begs Jesus to do something else. He begs that Jesus would let him go with him. This is the proper response to mercy. When the Lord demonstrates his mercy toward us, when he has compassion on us, the proper response that we should have is a desire to be with him, to follow him. This man had the opportunity to physically be with Jesus, to physically follow him. And Jesus says no. That might also be something you don't expect as you read through the Gospels. For Jesus to say, no, don't come and follow me. It's not because this man wasn't worthy or that he wasn't ready, that he needed to go and study first. No, that's not it at all. But Jesus wouldn't let him get into the boat because he had something else for him to do. I think this is a great comfort for this man and for us. God has a divine purpose for every one of his children. The opportunity that this man wanted and thought would be the best for him to be with Jesus, that was denied to him, but he was given another plan, a better plan to follow. It was a plan that ultimately meant more people were made aware of God's mercy and love than they would have if he had gone with Jesus. We have no record of Jesus coming back to this area. As far as we know, this is the only time that Jesus was ever here. And yet, the message of Jesus and what he had done spreads throughout the entire Decapolis. All 10 cities end up hearing about what Jesus had done. And all of that because Jesus told this man to stay. So one way that we could look at this, one way that we could apply this passage of Scripture to our own lives is to ask the question, where has God placed you? And what has he called you to do? So often we hear that, and I think sometimes we can get a little bit jaded. Maybe you've been to missions conferences or things, and people are always asking you, so won't you go across the world, across the seas, and follow Christ? But maybe the answer is, where are you right now? Maybe that's where God could use you. Maybe it's you have a job that you don't really like or coworkers that you don't really get along with. Well, that's where you are. Maybe you're in a season of life that is difficult for you. Do you believe that you are actually where God wants you and where God could use you to reach other people? Jesus' words to this man, I think, are the exact same words that he would give to us this morning. Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you. This is the call that's for every one of us, whether we are an ordained missionary or pastor, or maybe we feel like the least in God's kingdom. Maybe that's how you feel this morning. Well, it doesn't matter. Every one of us has been put in a position to be able to tell others what the Lord has done for us. We can't control their responses. We don't need to have answers to every single question that they have. just need to tell them what the Lord has done for us. This summer, we studied a book called Organic Outreach. How can we naturally share the gospel with people around us? And in many ways, that book could be said to be an explanation of this one verse. Do you want to know how you can share the gospel, or at least how you can begin sharing the gospel? Well, here's how you do it. Tell other people what the Lord has done for you. They might reject it, but that's not for you to decide. For us, it is to simply tell people what the Lord has done. God will continue to pour out His mercy on this earth. He's going to continue to do amazing things and to transform people. Yes, He comes and He meets everyone where they are at. But He doesn't leave them there. I think that's really hopeful. He didn't leave me to continue on in my sins, but He changes me. Many will respond in fear and rejection because they don't want to be changed. But some will be ready to listen. So for those of us who have been changed, our response to seeing God's mercy, the mercy that He has shown to us, it should be to go home to our friends and to our neighbors and to tell them all that God has done for us and all that God continues to do in us. That's how we should respond to God's mercy.